Welcome everybody to Faded Mates. It is week after Sweet Ruin. It's like before BSR and, you know, SR.
It's like a life event, right? Like, we were in Dallas last week for my son's volleyball tournament, and we saw the place where Kennedy was shot, like the grassy knoll. Okay, they're like, right, and everybody who lives through that, it's like before and after. For you, us, is before and after Sweet Ruin. But I've got to tell you, the grassy knoll, first of all, it's not very much of a knoll. But second, there is literally an X painted on the middle of a working road.
No.
And all it is surrounded by tourists, and then in between cars driving by, people run out and stand on the X and take pictures.
Oh,
and
God.
I was like, this is some sort of metaphor for America, and I don't know what it means.
I know what it means.
We're fucked.
It is the player week, everyone. We're so excited. Jen and I are especially excited because we have a guest with us this week. Our dear friend and friend of the pod, Kate Claiborne, is back.
Hi.
And you guys, we're going to reveal some secrets about ourselves, about us as a threesome, because we have a group text, and it is titled Vika, Do Not Leave Me, Punches Window. So it's going to be a ride today, everyone. We love the player in this house.
We do. It's funny because as I was rereading for this event, I noticed, I texted the group text and was like, you know, he actually punches the window first and then says, do not leave me. Maybe we should change our working title.
We're never going to change it.
We're never going to change it.
I have to tell you. So two things. One, I am already blushing. Like, we have not talked. And my face is like hot. I can feel my face being hot right now. But also, this just very recently, I had to get a new car because my car was like a million years old. And so I had to buy a car, and my car has a lot of technology that I've never had before, including, you know, it will make my phone talk to me.
Oh boy.
And so if I'm in the car and I get a text from one of you in the thread, the car will say, text from
Vika, do not leave me, punches window. Sorry, Sarah, but Sweet Ruin isn't the best Hyatt book.
Actually, but that's making me realize, like, I have some really weird text thread names in my phone. And so now I'm like, oh, that's really fun. Maybe we should rename this text thread for Kate now and then.
I'm blushing. We'll just say that I'm blushing. I had a funny text name for, I think, like the one we had with Sierra Simone, and I can't remember what it is now.
Oh, boy.
I don't even remember. It was something funny, though. Kate.
Yes.
You are here with us. We are not just to embarrass you, although I'm sure Sarah and I will both delight in that. Tell us, like, why is so, like, we had you on. Oh, wait, can I tell everybody else something really actually interesting? We had you on for Best Friend Sibling.
Yeah.
And in between then and now, we have actually discovered that our brothers know each other.
Yes.
Which is really fucking weird, everybody.
It's really true. It is a small world.
The world is real small.
Yeah, it's real small. And we've talked about it, and then we've just tried to forget that it exists.
Totally.
I think.
And I'm like, Ohio, that's all that you need to know how that happened. But now so tell us, like, before we like launch into talking about Sarah's second favorite romance of all time.
Yes.
Why is this the one, like, what is it about this one that is like, why do we bring you on for this?
So, I mean, I do think in part it's to embarrass me. But
there are no chastity belts in this book.
Right. I mean, there's other things. So
we could have brought you on for chastity belts.
I will say that when I started reading this series, it was because Sarah told me to. It's like very early in our friendship, Sarah was like, "You need to read these books."
This is how I test the quality of a friendship.
Yeah, I mean, that was taking a risk, I felt. Anyway, so when I got to this book, I mean, the previous two were also challenging for me on the Claiborne scale. But this one,
it's like the opposite of the Simone scale.
Yeah, it's
like
the inverse of the Simone scale.
It's like drinking tea with a tea bag you've already used. It is not at all a sex joke.
Boy.
Like, that's like the Claiborne scale.
Oh, you know what, Jen? Since you've said that, I need to tell you that one of the most humiliating moments of my life was being at a party. And it was like, you know, when I was young, I was like in, but I was in my early 20s or something. And somebody made a joke about teabagging. And I was like, what is that? Oh, like, no. I, to this group of young, cool people, I was like, what is it when people say that? So, like, obviously I had heard it in my lifetime before.
Sure.
But did not. So, anyway.
Never say, what is that, ever. Yeah. Just fucking pretend.
Yeah. Just pull out your phone and Google it.
Yeah, that's what I should have done. Anyway. Okay, so the reason why this book I thought would be interesting to talk about is because it has like three things in it that should otherwise make me, on a personal level, not finish a book. So
welcome to the full crest.
I know. So one is that a main character is like a grifter or a con artist.
Yeah.
So the heroine of this book is a con artist, and she's from a family of con artists. And I really, there are very few books I have ever been able to finish that feature some kind of con or long game or like somebody lying to the other person about their identity. So, I mean, that already, like, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to deal with this book because of that plot.
Right.
The second thing is that, you know, as with a lot of Cressley's books, and now because I've read the Immortals After Dark books and these books, I'm more, I guess, familiar with it, but it has this, the hero of this book has this terrible sort of sexual assault and trauma in his young life. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is I don't read a lot of books with like BDSM. There's like just,
although this is like pretty light, like she uses that word, but I was like, he just spanks her a few times, whatever.
Right.
I guess that thing with the belt's fine.
Right. Right. So I think one of the things I'm interested in about Cressley's books in general is like, how does she get buy-in from readers who I think would otherwise be like, I'm not sure if this is like the kind of plot I usually read or whatever. So I think that's why I'm on this.
Yeah. I feel like is something we've been exploring for 30 some episodes.
And I have a theory about like why I have buy into it, but I don't want to talk about that until we've talked a bit about the sort of plot of the book.
Yeah. Okay.
The player.
The player. Sarah's favorite. Yeah. Just all of Sarah's buttons being pushed, lighting up.
It's true. So we had Sophie Jordan on for The Master, and she explained that her whole theory of these three books, The Professional, The Master, and The Player, is that one of them will just hit you hard in the id, and that will be like your core, like, give it to me romance. Like, you'll figure out so much about like your own personal like kink and id by virtue of which of these books is your favorite. And this book is my favorite by far of the three. And it will come as no surprise at this point because we just did a 2-hour episode on Sweet Ruin. And Ruin is so similar. Like, the stories are very similar. Or the characters are so similar. But no one loves a broken hero like me.
So I want you to like say a little bit about that. Like, where you see the kind of overlap between Sweet Ruin and this book.
Well, I think that first of all, I think they both have these sort of deeply traumatic pasts that we'll get into. Yeah. And if you haven't read The Player, there big, big content warnings about the past here.
I think you should say childhood sexual assault. I think you should say, like,
and you kind of, if you, you know, if you've read the other two, you've gotten,
you know, the
you
bad
know
one.
Yeah, you've kind of gotten hints of this, right? But it's really explained in this one.
Well, and we just don't see it to the same level in the other two because it doesn't happen. It happens to Dimitri in a way that it doesn't happen to the others. Like, the others are tangentially related to this,
right?
But he is the most victimized of the three. at least physically. So he is in a place where, this is such a hard book to talk about if you haven't read it, because we're going to have to talk, like, there are going to be spoilers abound, because I want to talk too about the way that the book is crafted to reveal. So much of the book is clouded in this kind of mystery of who Dimitri is and why he is the way that he is, why he's so intensely controlling, why he seems to be, I mean, he is in, and when we say controlling, like intensely controlling, to the point where he basically kidnaps her into marriage.
Yeah.
You know what? Before you continue, one
you
of the things.
What?
You know what? It wasn't kidnapping.
Here's what I want to talk about, because I think one of the things we've talked about is like Cressley's, like the evolution of Cressley using first person throughout these books. And it strikes me that this is like, and we joked in the first one, it was like watching her learn to drive stick shift in a Ferrari, because it was it didn't really work for us, right? Because the hero was too hidden from us. And then in the second book, we get a heroine who understands the hero really well and knows exactly how to, like, kind of make that work for her. And so right, it's like a revelation. It, like, works so much better for us because we're so much more connected through her being connected, right? This third one is then, like, the masterstroke, because we think that Vika the entire time, like, knows him and is playing him. And then it's like a magician at work. And at the end, there's this big reveal. And so she doesn't even really know she's been kidnapped into marriage, right? Like, she just thinks, I mean, it's so fucking brilliant. And I feel like the craft of Cressley's writing, where she goes from, like, how she manages that, right? Like, here's a woman who knows everything that's going on and is in full control. And then at the end, instead, like, the curtain gets pulled back and we see, oh no, she didn't understand a lot the entire time. And it's so fucking good.
Well, I would be really interested in hearing Kate talk about this, because I don't write in first person, but I agree, Jen, that this is a masterclass in how to use first person for the text, right? Because what the biggest problem, at least one of the big problems that I have in YA first person, is something that my friend Carrie Ryan, who writes YA, says all the time, which is often in YA, the heroine says things like, well, you know, they can know everything about me except my secret, period.
Yeah.
And she's thinking, the writers use that to hold information back from the reader. But no one actually thinks that way.
Right.
No one says, like, accept my secret. They say, like, accept the fact that I robbed a bank. Right. So, but which is, you know, a writing challenge is, like, how do you give everything away and still maintain conflict in a book? And what Cressley does here is she establishes a character who is keeping so many secrets publicly from the hero, but the reader knows everything. And then, bam.
Yeah.
The hero's been keeping all these secrets too, but you didn't know either.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the book, when there's like the reveal, when he sort of comes and explains everything, like, for me, the end, that last, I think it's just in the last chapter where he reveals everything, I was like, wow, this is like a lot to take in. It's like a lot of information. So, I mean, the risk of doing that, right, is that you are forcing yourself into kind of a weird, like, info dump, because eventually he has to come clean, right, in order for you to feel okay about the book, right?
Right. But the revelation, her revelation that he's been playing her the whole time, is really remarkable. Like, now here we are talking about the end, but the structure of when her family comes to her and says, like, we figured out there's a problem. He's been after you for a year. Look at all these pieces. The pieces of the puzzle start to fall together. The punching of the window, which we'll get to. And then she leaves and she's watching all the video.
Yeah.
And she sees, and this goes back to my sweet ruined broken hero love, is like, she sees how totally devastated he was. I mean, so here's the deal. Dimitri was going to kill himself. He was so broken by, you know, and devastated by his past that he couldn't get past it into, he couldn't live his life at all, happily. Right. And so we discover that, like, on the night when he was at his lowest point, when he was, you know, planning to kill himself, he sees his fated mate, right? Yeah. On the floor of the casino, and then commits to changing himself to win her.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's my catnip. Like,
yeah.
Like, which is terrible. This is not good. I'm working through it with my therapist, you guys. this is not a great thing for somebody to have as an id, because, like, you two just want to, like, heal. Right?
I think in its idealized form, though, the other part of
what's... he's also a trillionaire.
Sure. And he's literally like, you're not working hard enough to spend my money. You need another pool. She does have a pool. One of the things, like, you guys, I just want my own pool so bad. One of the things I would say about that, though, is the appeal is, I mean, we in modern romance expect heroes to change, right? Not just heroines. So I think to have a romance hero preemptively understand that he needs to change, that that's really powerful, as opposed to her berating him that he must change, right? Like, and I think there's something really fucking sexy about that, right? Like, yep. I'm a wreck, and I need to be in a position to be good enough for you. I mean, yeah, that's fucked up when I say it, but I'm going to tell you right now.
It's delicious.
It was real fucking hot. Yes.
Well, I think what's interesting listening to you guys talk about this is, like, my kind of attraction to this book is somewhat, I don't know, it's different than both of yours, I think.
That's because you're more balanced than us, probably.
No, I mean, I, as you guys know, I love a damaged hero too. And he, of course, is really, he's really damaged. But I guess for me, like, one thing that I think, when I think about why this book appeals to me, I think what it is that I think it's about her for me. So her life is, you know, if you're listening to this and you haven't read the book, so she comes from this family of con artists, and this has been her life's work, is to work as a grifter, and she does all different kinds of cons. And for the last year, her cons have gone cold, right? Like, she has not been able to carry out one of these grifts successfully, and it's really difficult for her. And there is a lot riding on this for her, because her family is in quite a bit of trouble, right? And so there's a lot of burden on her from her family. She doesn't, like, she feels like her sister is the more beautiful. Her brother is, like, kind of a tech superstar. She also just got out of a relationship in sort of a terrible way. Her fiance was cheating on her, and it was, like, you know, awful. And she had tried to be a lot of things for him too. He was a football coach. She hated sports, but tried to get into them for him and all this stuff. So I just feel like her life, like, when you first meet her, you think this woman is going to be awful because what she does for a living is, like, con people.
Right.
But she is burdened by a lot of things. And when she meets Dimitri, he is so devoted to her and to her only. And it's like all he wants to give her is freedom from all those things.
That's the appeal of the billionaire, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the appeal of the duke. It's the appeal of the king. Is this idea that they'll take care of you.
Yeah, and he also just wanted...
And your family. I mean...
Yeah, and her family, right?
I mean, we cannot do this book without talking about families, because the level of familial loyalty that occurs in this book is far more than in any of the others. And there is this piece that I imagine, Kate, is part of why you love it so much, that, like, Dimitri understands her from the go.
Right.
Like, from the moment they meet, it's like he's in her head.
Yeah, and he's going to release her from, you know, she thinks of herself as like a grifter, that's like a fundamental thing about her. But, you know, like when you're sort of paying attention to her in the text, what you see is that, like, you know, it's not like she wouldn't have chosen that life for herself, right? She does it out of loyalty to her family, but she has other things that she wants to pursue. Yeah. But she would never do it, right? Because she's so loyal to this family. And he wants to give her freedom, which is ironic since he kidnaps her, basically. But whatever.
No,
I mean,
yeah. But is it really kidnapping if you end up in a glass house owning half of California?
Not right. Really. I would say no.
Yeah.
With your own pool.
And your, like, massive design studio. Like, yeah. Is it really kidnapping?
Right. You know what, though? I think that, but Kate, I think the part, so it's yeah, it's that for sure. But I think the other part that I think is really interesting about this is his devotion to her before he even knows her is what allows him to reconcile with his brothers. And that's the part about this book that I actually think is really wonderful, because I don't, personally, one of the things that I found is, like, when I married my husband, he, like, helped me love my family better because he loved his family so much. And I think that that's, like, the ideal partnership is someone who makes you stronger, right? And the fact that, so it's, yes, her devotion and loyalty to her family is so important, but it's also this bridge for him to find his way back to his brothers. And I think that's really, I loved that too. Like, I just found that really poignant in a book that's about this much sex.
Yeah. And they teach him how to be with her. So, like, I think one of a really kind of like poignant moment in the book is on their wedding night, he, you know, it's like the first time they're going to consummate the marriage, but he is absolutely terrified that kind of the manifestation of his trauma is that he dissociates during sexual activity, and he's terrified that this is going to happen with her. And so he stops, like, just before they're getting ready to have sex, and he leaves and calls his brother. Yeah. And, you know, you obviously don't hear that call because he's in the other room and you're in her head. But when he comes back in and he says something to her like, you must be anxious. Like, I'm sorry, you must be anxious. And she says, like, it sounds like he's repeating somebody else's words.
Yeah.
And that I thought was so sweet, that, like, his brother was obviously, like, helping him figure out how to talk with her.
Yeah.
Although I was thinking back to the master and I was like, how would he be good at this?
Not even a little bit.
But anyway, he's changed.
Wait, is that who he calls? I just assumed he...
It's Maxim.
It's Maxim he calls. Yeah, Maxim. He should have called the other one.
The other one helped him with the mob stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, everybody has their skills.
Right.
I'm sorry, but we never would have believed, as readers, having gone through book one and two, if he would have called the first brother
Sebastian,
we would have been like, what? That dude knows nothing. He's just like... Ugh,
he's going to be like, go into the sauna and whip her with banyan leaves. Yeah. Like,
no, Maxim's the one who, yes, he talked to the right brother. Good job.
Yeah,
Maxim's like, I'm sending you a chastity belt.
Oh, man.
No, I mean, there's so much to love about this. So it's interesting because in The Master, we had this conversation when we did the recording on the Master with Sophie, that I always forget there's a wedding in the middle of The Master.
Oh,
because
right.
Like, it's just such a, like, weird moment of domestic idol.
So, but I have a theory about why, and I'll go back to it.
No, go ahead.
Well, because remember, you were like, it was funny, I was re-listening and you were like, I don't know why it's there. And I was like, you know why? Because that whole book is so claustrophobic in the middle, like, in a good way, right? It's just them together.
Right.
And we would never believe that they would work unless we saw them with other people, right? So you have to, like, blow out their world a little bit. And I think that it makes sense then that it's going to be this wedding, because she's married and he doesn't know. And there has to be a crisis that has to, like, you know, that has to be resolved as well. So I just thought, it made sense, actually. We didn't talk about it much, but I was like, no, there was a reason it was a wedding and not just like a party.
Sure. Okay. I'll buy it. I mean, fine.
You had to establish that Maxim was good at toasts.
Yeah. But she knew how to decorate a limo.
Oh my God. Anyway.
But in this one, you have, like, what's amazing is that he's already come to this idea of knowing. He's known her first outside of the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For a year. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously he hasn't known her, but man, it feels like he did. You know, he's been watching her. This is super creepy. Yes. It's super creepy when you say it out loud.
I know.
It's
like,
so good. I mean, he's been watching her for a year and learning her and learning what she loves and learning. I mean, he's been, oh my God, he really has. It's creepy.
It's really, I really think it's like that part of the book is sort of terrifying.
He's been tracking her phones. He's been listening to her phone conversations. He's been reading her emails.
It's terrifying.
I mean, there's the whole thing with the ex, with the like fiance, which is probably the only, okay, look, in while I'm doing this at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, it feels like this is all super creepy. But the one thing, like when I'm reading this book, because I can't sleep at 2 a.m. For the 43rd time, the one thing that always feels real unpleasant to me is the way that he traps the fiance.
Yeah.
So Vika is engaged to a guy who's like, perfectly nice. She's just not her fated mate, or he's not her fated mate. And then one day she discovers that he's cheating on her, or that he has cheated on her. She walks in on them. It's one night. He's basically like, it only happened one time. I'm sorry, it was a huge mistake. And she's like, no, we're done. And then he tries to win her back. And like once a week, he sends her an email that tell about a memory that he has of her. Like he clearly cares for her.
Yes.
And turns out, of course, Dimitri has affected this entire scheme.
Yeah.
So that they wouldn't get married.
The part that was like really fascinating about it, because like I felt the same way, right? I was like, okay, this is actually real fucking terrible. Is at the end, like, right, so the everyone who has not read this book just really needs to go read it before they listen. The end, when she's like, I can't believe you did that. He's like, well, you thought that your family set us up this way and you were ready to forgive them. So why not me? Like once you're running the con, right? Like the rules of the con must apply. And I thought that that was like really the only way to trick us as readers into like buying it too, right? Like we are just as susceptible to like the long con as she herself is. And I, again, like that's a part of the text that I think is like brilliant, because like, yeah, as you say it, I'm like, this is actually really terrifying. And anyone listening to us right now thinks we're nuts. But in the context of the book and their world, he did what he needed to do to get his end goal, which is her. And therefore, it's all, like, legal.
Well,
even though I'm like, ugh.
Well, so I
Kate's like, no.
Kate's like, point of order.
Well, here's what I'll say. I will say, for me, the end of the book remains terrifying, right? If I reread this book, I don't even read the end. It is, think it is.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wait, do you read the part where he punches the window?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, so where do you stop?
I just go to the epilogue.
What?
Because I do think it's like I don't like to think about it. And this kind of goes back to like, you know, not like I have trouble with books where somebody's hiding their identity or something like that. But what I will say is what I think Cressley tries to do is show that it's not scary to her because she respects the con, right? So like,
well, that whole family scene,
right?
Oh yeah,
when they go back and they're looking at all the videos and the con, it's coming together, like what he's been doing all this time,
right?
And the grandparents are like, ooh, oh, look at that,
right?
Like, respect.
Like Kate is in the window like, you guys should learn to respect people's privacy. This is still not okay. No, but anyway, I think what Cressley is doing is making it like, it is okay for her because this is part of who she is too. It is part of
yeah, that world.
Who her family
yeah,
is,
she
right?
certainly tapped a phone in her day.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
She was going to clone his phone, right? That's what yeah. she wanted to do, and she missed the
opportunity.
Well,
the whole thing, I mean, the whole thing was a con. She thought she was stealing $500 billion from
yes.
him.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, that is the other thing. Like, we have, we sort of, Cressley has really, it's amazing because the level of conning that is going on from Vika's perspective, the, you know, I'm going to grift him. I need to make this money. Yes, I'm going to marry him. There's no prenup. Like, she starts to feel very guilty about
oh, yeah.
the amount of money that they're going to con from, like, that she'll have access to, the kind of whole, the whole thing starts to feel squicky to her.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, like, she really could be dinged hard by romance readers as an unlikable heroine because of the level of conning that she's doing.
Right.
But by the end, when you see that he's been conning, like, you know, the spinner has been spun.
Right.
Right? Like, you then suddenly you're like, oh, no, they're perfect. It's Cat versus Cat.
Right.
And it really, really is. There's such a magnificent, he respects her. And I think part of that, again, it's family, right? Like, he respects the, like, family business, her family business.
Right.
In such a really remarkable way.
And he doesn't really apologize. Like, and I think this is, in a way, this is, like, what impresses her family. But, like, when she says to him, like, how could you have set up, what was the fiance's name? Brett. When she says to him, like, you set up Brett, and he says, I would have thrown like 1,000 women in his way to yeah. get to you, whatever. And, like, the people in the family are like, oh.
Respect.
Yeah. So.
And then there's, like, the Russian grandfather who's like, that's because he's Russian.
Yeah.
Like, it all feels so, like, I mean, having been raised by an Italian, which is not a Russian, but still, like, has that sort of, like, you know, feel of, like, Italians are Italians. My dad would have said the exact same thing. Like, yeah,
yeah,
it's because he's Italian, right?
I mean, your dad probably would have been like, geez, he was cloning your phone.
Honey, maybe you should run away. But you know what it reminds me of? Have you guys seen that movie, The Usual Suspects, with Kevin, right? I mean, the whole idea that, like, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, when you buy into the world of, like, the con artist, right? Like, the rules just sort of change. And I think that that's the only, like I said, I think it's the only reason why this, like, book doesn't freak me out, right? Because there, it's like when I watch a movie, any, like, movie like that, I'm just like, this is not my world, right? Like, I'm, you know, I'm not going to drive around at 100 miles an hour. Well, okay. I'm not going to, like, steal things. I'm not going to whatever. Like, so I just feel like, yeah, if I logically think about it, and the term, I mean, it's not even, like, a contemporary romance. It's not. It's paranormal-like in that the excessive nature of his, like, obsession with her just feels like fated mates. I had to do whatever I had to do to get her. It doesn't even feel like a contemporary book at all. It's completely devoid of, like, reality.
No, and
right?
I think she knows that. Like, craft-wise, I think she's giving you nods to that throughout.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, you know, when they first meet, he's staring up at the full moon, right?
I love that part.
Yeah, she says something about being a she-demon to him. I don't know if she, like, said
yeah.
something like I could be, right? And so there's, like, little things throughout the book where I think Cressley's, like, actually giving a nod to that. Like, sort of, this is not reality, right?
Right.
Like,
No, well, there's, I mean, and there are so many echoes to IAD
yeah.
in it. There's a moment where Kat looks at the diamond that he buys her, which is massive, and she's like, massive rock, mine.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God,
oh, yeah.
she's a Valkyrie.
Yeah.
Like.
Right.
Yes. She loves pretty things. She loves cars. She loves jewelry. She loves clothes.
And I love that every time she gets something from him, she texts her brother, like, or her family,
yeah.
the group text, which surely has a name. And it's like, and then they, like, immediately tell her how much money. Like,
it's worth, yeah.
how much money she's just won them.
Did you guys think that there were going to be other books featuring her family?
The friend, I was sure the friend would be involved, would get a book.
Well, I mean, yeah.
At first, I thought they were all going to get books, but then in the epilogue, like, some little threads seem to be getting tied
the
up.
The sister and the boy and the sister husband.
And her husband.
Yeah.
And then, but also her brother and Jess, which is right, like the friend, right?
Yeah.
I just think, you know, just write a couple short stories and put them in your newsletter for us, Cressley. But also Monroe, focus.
Oh, okay.
Well, so for just sort of business purposes, this book was self-published. The first two were published by Simon & Schuster.
Really?
And this book was self-published. Yes.
Huh.
So,
That's real interesting.
I don't know why, but I know that that is true.
Wow. That's fascinating to me.
I mean, presumably because they just decided that they didn't want to do any more contemporary mafia books with her. And she was like, well, there's one more brother, so I'm going to do it. And thank God for that, Cressley.
Because it's Sarah's favorite.
Because it's my favorite.
Can I tell you something? Because you know I love The Master a whole lot. And I have not reread The Player in a long time. And I reread it beginning to end and was like, ooh, this might be tied. It's really fucking good.
Jen, you like that. You like that exhibitionist stuff.
I do. You know what, though? Here's what I kept thinking. I was like, okay, look. He's cloned her phone. He's, like, stalking her.
Whatever.
How the fuck, in the process of, like, doing that, do you figure out something about someone, like they're an exhibitionist without them ever, like she doesn't even know that about herself. That was like the one thing I kept thinking about. I was like,
isn't that a little bit like, they're all like that. Like Maxim is like, Kat, I know you want to be like spanked and given a chastity belt with two dildos.
I guess.
Like, and she's like, you're right, I do.
I guess.
But I think it's part of that.
It's faded mate.
Yeah. And it's part of that same narrative, like, right, like what I was saying, that she is kind of adrift, right? And all he wants is to like give her all the things that she wants but cannot for all these various reasons get for herself, right? Like she's too weighed down by other things to be able to get them for herself. And he makes those things happen for her. So like in the book, kind of a, I don't know, I think it's like sort of in the middle of the book when she tells him she can't come from oral.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I like have hives. I think I felt a hive. Anyway. And he's like, well, like I'm going to make that happen. Right.
Yeah.
And so like in every way, like sexually, financially, all these things, he wants to sort of free her of these other preoccupations.
Another way in which he is like Rune, because he is a virgin and superior at cunnilingus.
Right.
Like, superior.
He also is he's pierced.
Oh yeah
for control purposes,
right?
Well, it's interesting what he says, like, right, I just wanted it to be different, you know. And
right.
I think that part, there were things I did, you know, I kind of thought, oh, we should ask Adriana about like the trauma rep or whatever, although then I'm like, again, it's not reality. But I do like that he's been celibate for like 8 years. Right. And so he really has decided, like, and then was even like medicated to sort of handle his anxiety. And then he's like, you know, I guess the thing I didn't like is then he like Rocky, like essentially like puts himself on his own program to make himself a better man by like working out and not taking this medicine. And I felt like I was like, okay, that's kind of silly. But I think the idea that he, like, I don't know. I was just very won over by the idea that he was so self-aware.
Yeah, well, can we talk about sex for a little bit?
Because a little bit? A lot of it.
I mean, we can talk about it for the rest of the episode.
A lot of it.
Fine. But no, I mean, the moment, so there's that moment in sex with them all the time where he says, keep me here, right? Mm-hmm. Where he's afraid of dissociating. And she doesn't understand it, but she understands that whatever's happening between them is different than has ever been with him before.
For
like
him,
she instantly realizes that like something about, and she thinks it all the time. She's like, I can't, like he's heady for me. Like he's like a drug. Like I can't get out from underneath this. And part of it is that like even when we're having sex, like, or especially when we're having sex, like it feels like I'm everything to him.
Yeah.
Again, potentially creepy, but not in some way.
Yeah, because she's not ever been able to be everything to anyone, right?
Right. Like, well, what's interesting is that everybody calls her a vice. Like, yeah. She's her family calls her vice. Like,
yeah.
Technically, this whole thing could have been written in a way where he's like, he would feel addicted to her, but that's not what it is. He's not addicted to her. He just, like, she's his whole world.
Yeah.
She's precious to him
in
a way that a vice is not. You have a contentious relationship with vice, but he doesn't.
Right. And he said, like, that, you know, is the thing that she remembers. Like, when he says to her at one point in the book, he says to her, like, imagine the world is darkness and there's a single candle. Like,
yeah,
you're the candle or whatever. And that's, like, the thing that she keeps remembering that he has said to her. So, yeah, like, that's exactly it. His devotion to her is not about, like, she's something bad for him or something like that.
And there's also, so for somebody who kidnaps someone into marriage, there's also, like, not as much pressure. Like, I think it's such a light touch, which, again, is just smart on Cressley's part, because there are some really, like, magnificent moments where he's, like, the moment where he says to her, like, you're not working hard enough to spend money. Like, let me show you how much we are worth.
Yeah.
Like, so that you will just buy whatever you want. But my favorite moment in this whole book is such a beautiful light touch, which is when he looks at her and he's like, I want you to give me the ring you've had.
I know. For
a month. And I've been sneaking into your closet to put it on every day. Like, and it's so wonderful because she won't admit that she cares for him enough to have bought him a wedding ring.
Yeah.
And he is like,
I want to be claimed by you.
Like, he's desperate for it. And still he's been putting it on in secret for a month.
Yeah. See, these favorite moments that each of us have are, like, I think, super revealing about what kept us reading this book. So my favorite moment is, like, and I had told Jen this prior, but my favorite moment is, like, when her brother is, like, standing next to her and is kind of, like, trying to say, like, you know, she needs to come with me or whatever. And Dimitri says, like, you know, do not get between me and her. You do not want to do that. And I was like, this is my favorite thing in the whole book, right? Because, again, like, that's what I liked about the book, is that he was like,
yeah,
I'm going to just clean up all this shit in your life that is a problem for you.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, but let's be honest, the punch a window.
Yeah, I mean, that.
Sure,
yeah.
That part's great.
That also is great. Just making it bloody. Yeah, real upset.
But that is the part of the book. I mean, I love that scene viscerally, right? So Vika's brother and sister, Vika's family shows up and they're like, oh my God, you're being conned.
Yeah.
Like, something's happening. He's conning you. We have proof. And they're like, you have to come with us. And she's like, okay. And she starts to leave the casino and, like, they're in the car at the curb and suddenly, like, out the door comes Dimitri. Yeah. And they're like, fuck, we have to go. And then she's like, they lock the doors and he's like grabbing the handle and he's gone feral.
Yeah.
He's feral at this point.
Did anyone else wonder, though, how they were able to actually have a conversation between the closed window?
Yeah, he's really loud, Jen. I
guess there's a part where she mumbles something and she, like, understands. I guess it's his super secret hearing because he's an immortal.
They're connected.
And then he's like punching the window and he bloodies his hand. And I'm like, holy shit, I should not love this. Like, in the moment, I'm like that every time.
And yet.
And her sister is like, fuck, we got to get the fuck out of here. This guy's crazy.
I know.
And he's just like, she's just like driving through Vegas and there's all this like smeared blood on her window.
And she is like sad.
She's
not scared.
She's sad.
Like, everybody's like, oh my God, he's a feral monster. He goes full. Kate, you like this because he's basically a Lyke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Staring at that full moon.
Of course.
And he goes full, like, what's it called? I don't even know. What's the wolf?
Wolf hologram.
The wolf hologram.
In that moment.
Except that his hologram can punch.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. I want to talk about my favorite.
Do your favorite, Jen.
Okay. Because I feel like it's to, I'm going to talk about, well, okay, I really like the part where he, like, figures out she's an exhibitionist, obviously, in the back of that club and unzips her in front of everybody because right. I'm a dirty girl. But the part I actually really love in this book is she has this, like, ridiculous 15-carat diamond ring. And basically, if she gives it to her sister, they can fence it and they will be out of, like, money problems.
Yes.
And she does not want to give up her ring. And she knows it's this huge risk to basically roll up to him and be like, look, I need $3 million for my family. But she, the scene where she asks him for the money anyway, and basically is like, sit down. And she's like, oh, fuck. And he's like, I am humiliated that I have not made this clear to you that this is our money. And then he's like, why don't you give me like a number so I can just wire it to them immediately? And she's like, I can't believe you're going to do that. I can't believe you sent them $3 million. And he's like, look, I sent them five so that they will know next time that they can come to us.
Right. Okay. I will say that when he gave them five, I was like, you know what? These people are not responsible with money. Anyway.
But he's a trillionaire.
Yeah, that $5 million is like fell out of his fucking couch cushion.
Okay.
Well, I feel like we also need to clarify, you guys, that is not hyperbole. He is actually a trillionaire. This book is ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It's over the top.
I mean, yeah, it's cool that he's like, I gave them more than you wanted. But for her, right, as the heroine, and I think that's why, like, I do agree with Kate. It's like the heroine in this book is so meaningful to me. Where she, despite her fear and her love and her loyalty to her family, it's this step towards her husband as being part of that too. And I, like, and her, it's like so brave. Like, she knows this could all go really sideways. And yet,
she's
like, and it's also that she wants her ring, right? Yeah. She, like, wants both. She's like, both and. I want my family and I want my marriage. And I fucking love that scene.
Yeah. She's trying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, and she's trying to learn to trust somebody who is not her family.
Which... And who sets off all of her signals that there's something she hasn't figured out yet.
Such
right?
as the stalking.
She has the sense of a gron. What the hell is that?
I don't know.
She has the sense of a grifter.
Yeah.
Don't let me, Eric, take out the part where I say gron.
I don't know what that is, but
okay. She has like the sixth sense of a grifter.
Yeah.
There's a really important thing that we have to talk about.
Oh boy.
On this podcast. And it's about punctuation.
The title of this podcast.
The title of this podcast is going to be Sexclamation Points. Because from the first Presley book I have ever read, I have been obsessed with her use of exclamation points.
I mean, well, we should also say, Kate, your books basically use zero exclamation points.
Well, I want to give some backstory for that, which is that I had a teacher once who told me, as a writer, you get 2 exclamation points in your entire writing life. And like,
that's what Benjamin Dreyer says in Dreyer's English. I should go look it up right now.
He says something very similar. Yeah.
Well, those people have not read a Cressley Cole novel.
Right. And I don't think any writing advice like that is good writing advice, but nevertheless, it really stuck with me, right? Like, I was like, yeah, like this is a punctuation mark you have to deploy with extreme discretion.
Not when you're an immortal coming.
No. Cressley loves an exclamation point. And in the sex scenes, there are exclamations everywhere.
I don't think I've ever noticed that.
Capital letters, too. Like, all caps.
There's so many announcements. There's so many announcements in the sex scenes.
So wait, this is weirdly relevant. I have a 5-year-old and she learned, you know, she was in kindergarten this year and she learned about the exclamation point. And I don't know how they taught the exclamation point to kindergartners, but basically anytime she gets to the end of a sentence, like let's say it's like, it's sunny out today, exclamation point. She goes, it's sunny out today.
Okay. Well.
So now I just want every sex scene where Cressley's books to be like, I'm coming.
Oh my god. I will say it's funny to me because it is something that, because I teach middle school, that there are kids who I'm like, look, like, punctuation cannot actually do the work for you. Like, verbs have to. And therefore, if you're going to, like, write a sentence and you just want 20 exclamation points to tell me how excited I should be, maybe you should just make the words in that sentence better.
Well, that is not Cressley. Cressley likes an exclamation point.
Cressley can do whatever
Cressley
she wants.
Would disagree. Yeah. Cressley's Picasso. Yeah. Cressley is the Picasso of exclamation points.
What are rules?
And now that I have told you, now that I've said this,
you're going to notice that,
and everybody who listens to this podcast is going to be like, you know what? There are a lot of exclamation points.
Exclamation points.
And you're not going to hate it. You're going to be like, you read a sex scene, you're going to be like, where's the sexclamations here? Must not be enjoying
this is
it that
very
much.
Not good sex.
Anyway, what I think about it is that I think this would bother me anywhere else, except that Cressley's books are, like, intense from page one to page 250.
Exactly. They gnaw off their leg right on page one.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, there better be a sexclamation point there.
I have always noticed the sexclamation points in Cressley's books, but there are more of them in the contemporaries. And I think part of that is because it's basically, like, human heroines having sex with immortal heroes. In
sure.
Books.
Right. Right. How else would it feel?
What?
There actually aren't words in English for me to describe how your 7-foot monster cock feels.
Yeah, foghorn leghorn is.
The heroines don't even have words to accompany their exclamations. It's just exclamation points in quotation marks.
I challenge you, Kate, if I don't find an exclamation point in love lettering, I'm going to be real fucking disappointed.
There's definitely not a sexclamation
point. I don't know.
I also feel like with sexclamation points, you have to really lean in. Like, you can't just have one.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You have to really, like, embrace the sexclamation point. I don't think I've ever written a exclamation point in a sex.
No. What's funny is that there should be, you know, there's like a scene in this book where he's like, oh, I have a surprise for you. And I, like, I don't know, in like 12 hours time, he has managed to put together this, like, insane room where there's, like, all these toys. And what should be an exclamation point is, like, every time he, like, holds up some piece of equipment, she should be like...
Just think, exclamation point.
It's a what?
I will say, if we are going to talk about punctuation, I have noticed that she does, like, an ellipse. I will say that. Ellipses.
Yeah, well,
fine.
I mean,
that's not very exciting. I guess it's like, it's like, what's the opposite of a sexclamation point? Yeah. Like, right?
It is the opposite.
Yeah, you're like, okay, let me slow this down a little.
I bet those aren't in the sex scenes very often.
Like, I'm gonna have to look. Now I'm all like,
there are so many sex toys in these books. I get tired of it.
It
like,
seems
and
exhausting.
I know that maybe makes it seem like I'm a real bore.
I'm
but
a
like,
real bore.
My God. There are a lot. There's a lot going on.
Well, listen, Vika really got on board.
She really did. But I feel like, so here's the thing. So we finished the player, and then Cressley puts contemporaries away.
Yeah.
And so she's still writing, she's writing the YA books. She's writing, but which are paranormal. She's writing IAD. She's writing the Dacian series still. And she's not writing contemporary anymore.
Well, because it's like she did it, right?
She was like she like the player is like a masterclass.
Yeah,
and that's
right.
It.
Here's a challenge. I have met it. I guess I'll move on now. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So, but I would like to see that. I would like to see Jess as a heroine. Although she's a little Nixie in the sense that she's just got such a intense personality that, again, like, I don't know how you translate that to a heroine.
Oh, that's interesting. I'd never thought of that. But
well,
that
if anybody could do it would be Cressley, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What else? Mafia? There's, like, no mob, really anything at all.
No, that's really the first
He's just a tech genius.
Yeah.
He worked. He said something like he worked. He calculated it and he worked like a
He's
whole
worked
lifetime.
A lifetime already. I'm like, yeah, me too, motherfucker. I'm not a trillionaire. All I do is work. I have like 4 goddamn jobs. Like, do better.
What's wrong with you, Jen?
Jesus, I clearly everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's here's what I will say about this whole series, but especially this book. And maybe this is the reason why I love it the most. Like, yes, I love Adama Shiro. Yes, I love, you know, exclamation points. But the reality is that it's such pure fantasy.
This book. God, yes.
I mean, and not, and in a different way than the first two. Like the first one, I don't, you have to set the professional aside because that just feels like a kind of straight up contemporary. But like the master's fantasy, but in a different way. This is like pure elevated. I mean, it's just none of this happens to real people.
Yeah, right. No one fights a car for you in real life. Right? Yeah. No one's like, let me fight this car.
But there's, but also there's, from the start, it's this fantasy of like, imagine, and I know it's problematic. I know it is, but it scratches every itch, this idea that someone would see you across a casino floor.
Yeah.
And say, like, that is the person for me, and I am going to do everything I can to make myself the best version of myself before I go win her.
Yeah.
Like, when I come to her, I'm going to come to her perfection.
Yeah.
That's amazing and impossible, and I love it.
I think one of the things I would say upon rereading is, I mean, we've talked about, like, structurally, like, what I think she's doing with, like, kind of hiding. Like, we think we know the hero, but it's hidden. Is there's, you know, one of my, like, as a middle school teacher, like, kids love foreshadowing. Like, it's, like, kind of magical to them when you go back and you're like, do you see how this was said? And kids are like, oh, how did I miss that? And I was like, that's how it works. I will say, rereading it, I was really impressed by, like, really just how many clues there are that there he is doing something else. Mm-hmm. But because we trust her so much, right, that we don't really question it. And I do think, like, structurally, like, and I will say I like that feeling. I mean, you know, I was, like, a real sucker for, what was that movie where he was dead all along?
What? You know, I think you mean The Sixth Sense.
Yes, that's the one, right?
And then I thought you meant like Meet Joe Black.
No, or like, no.
He was knew. Satan all along. No, God of Death or whatever. Same.
That's even better than he was dead all along.
Right? The Sixth Sense.
Wicked
or,
Abyss is coming, you guys.
Or like The Usual Suspects. Like, I do like a big reveal, right? And I like to be surprised. Like the main character is.
Wait a
right?
minute. Were you guys surprised at the end?
The first time? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I was. That he was like pulling a long con on her? Yeah, I was. Huh. Fine, you're better than me. I fucking watched The Sixth Sense with my dad, who halfway through turned to me and was like, is he dead? And I was like, fuck you, dad. What's wrong with me?
You know, here's the thing that I want to say about this, because I actually have a lot of feelings about this question in books. Like, are you, yeah. were you surprised by the end? Mm-hmm. I spent, interestingly, like, for me, I, first of all, I love spoilers. Like, I hate not knowing the end of a book, which is partially why I think I'm a romance reader first yeah. and foremost. But, like, if I go to a thriller in the movies, like, I read the spoiler online before
oh,
I go.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Because I want to know how it ends. I want to be prepared. It makes – this is the largest bone of contention in my marriage, by the way, is that, like, I always know the ending of the movie when we go and sit down, and Eric thinks this, like, destroys his experience. Like, well, I don't know why it destroys his experience, because we're sitting next to each other, and I have my own brain, but whatever. He feels like it does. But – in this particular case, like, I felt this way about the Da Vinci Code, too, where I was like, I think this book is so clever. Like, I'm, you know, I had no idea that Jesus was a woman or whatever it was. I don't think that's the ending of that.
You're going to get
but
mail.
Whatever it is, Jesus gets married and has babies or whatever it is that ends the Da Vinci Code. And it's obviously it's all there. And the Da Vinci Code, part of, we can do a whole episode on why I love Dan Brown, which is that I think he makes readers feel real, real smart.
Yeah.
Because they figure it out like one page before the Harvard, you know, archaeologist figures it out.
Sure.
But the reality is like, I think when I'm reading romance and something like this is written into the plot, I'm not expecting it and I'm not looking for it. So it just becomes like a really easy, like, I am easily surprised by a twist ending in a romance novel because I don't expect it to be there. And then I'm just purely delighted.
Yeah.
You know, I think I would agree with all that. I think I am like I will often be surprised by twist endings, but I think this one maybe because of my, like I said at the very beginning, like the sort of con man, like grifter stuff.
You were tuned into it.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, once you say it that way, yeah, it does feel like
we were dumb. I mean, if it like hits whatever is your thing. But yes. Yeah. I mean, I think, well, and it's funny because somebody, I can't remember who we were talking about. Like someone's like, oh yeah, I don't like first person because I don't like unreliable narrators. And I was like, okay, there is not a single romance author alive who would write an unreliable first person narrator because no one would ever read their fucking books again. Right? Yeah. Like we have to trust that the narrators, regardless of like how it's being told, are telling us the truth about how they feel about the other person.
Authenticity,
right?
Is king.
And it is. And so to have a book that really like plays with that, but the lie is essentially because he was like, look, I know I'm broken, but I knew we were perfect for each other, so I had to figure out a way to get you essentially on the hook so you could figure out how we're perfect for each other, right? Like, I wouldn't have run the con if it wasn't for the fact that I knew it was the only way I could get you, right? And I think that's it. Like, the necessity of the con then is, like, it ties into him how broken he is.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why it ultimately works, because, again, it's, like, really rooted in self-awareness.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, to have that work for me, it really, it's like a deft hand, right? We always, in the hands of a lesser author. But, you know, when you have that's why, like you, Kate, I don't really actually enjoy books where one character is lying to the other. Because I feel like it breaks, like, a really fundamental, like, thing that I need to believe going into this relationship, which is that it's grounded in trusting each other.
I love a liar.
Yeah, and that's really, I mean, that's a kind of like in-depth way of thinking of it. I think for me, like, to when there is a plot like that, I find it very stressful. And like lie, I mean, not just, I mean, characters withhold things all the time, but it's like identity things.
Withholding,
like, really...
is different, I think, than lying, right? Yeah. Have you guys read, it's a YA book called One of Us is Lying? Sarah, you should read this book.
No, but I'm putting on my list because I do love a liar.
It's like four kids in like detention, and they each tell the story of how they got there, but one of them is a total lie, and you don't know which one. So it's very like Rashomon-like almost, right? Like, but on purpose, like one of them is like completely spinning a tale. And it's really a popular book among kids. Like, I think that really like triggers something in us, because I also think, we as people in the world like to think that we are above the con, right? That we are the ones who would be immune to being taken in this way. Mm-hmm. That we, right? And so to fall for it like she does, but because it's love, right, then we can sort of forgive it. Whereas if he was just, you know, and even her conning people, it's we only con people who are cons, right? Like, sort of that makes the lie, you know, like sort of all that mistrust and lying and duplicity kind of acceptable to us in a way. But I think it really triggers something in people to think, I would never fall for that. Right? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I do think that's like what you were saying about Dan Brown, Sarah. Like, we want to be the smartest people in the room. We want to be the ones to figure it out first. And books that like play with that, I think, can be really fun to read.
That's interesting.
Well, it also takes a deft hand as a writer to be able to give the reader the information, but just at the right moment.
Oh, God,
like,
yeah.
So you haven't failed in the mystery. You've succeeded in delivering a delicious reading experience. Like, the two, it is a really, really fine line that is difficult to walk. Because once you do feel, once you put together that Vika is being conned here, you have to feel, but you have to have both admiration for Cressley and feel like you see it all. Like, because that's the trick, is like, it can't be you're being conned, Vika, and then suddenly the reader's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, how? And it takes two chapters of info dump, right, to understand it. The reader has to immediately be able to put the pieces together, like in The Usual Suspects.
Right.
Right. Where suddenly you realize that Verbal is Kaiser Sose, and you're like, oh my God, it was there all along.
Yeah.
And she writes that scene where he comes out to the car so that you, like, the way she describes him, like, the look in his eye, and he's saying to her, like, I can explain this or whatever.
Yeah.
that, you know, then for the reader, it will like very easily click into place. Like, oh.
There's also this piece, right, and I meant to talk about this earlier, where we talk about, you know, for me at least, there that perception of he's changed himself into perfection for her long before he actually meets her and engages her in any way. Of course, that's not true, because he gets to her and he realizes he has to go the entire book in this sort of model of perfection. Like, he refuses to acknowledge, to like reveal himself to her in any way, which of course complicates everything. And then he has to ultimately change in an authentic way for her, for the two of them together. And that's the love story here, is like, you can try and be the perfect, the image of, you know, the image of perfection for your partner, but ultimately you can't know what perfection is for your partner until your partner is there in it with you.
Right. Do you think that she changes at all for him? I mean, like, we talked about her being free, but I mean, I think she really gets to like stay who she is, and also like reveal who her family is, which was like really important to her and a big reason why we knew it was never going to work out with Brett.
I don't think she changes, and I don't know that Cressley wanted to. I think it was like she gets to be who
she is,
and I like, I have crafted a man for her that is completely devoted to her and in love with every. I mean,
yeah.
Because part of me was sort of like, especially when I did the reread, part of me was sort of hopeful that like at the end she'd be like, you know what, like grifts are wrong, and I'm never gonna do it again.
No, the last line of the book is a grifter for a grifter, right?
Right.
Or a con for a con.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, I love a grifter. I love a liar.
Like, in a lot of books, like in a lot of romances, what we see is like both characters change, right? Like, they become better versions of themselves, or like a wound that they had is healed or something like that.
That's not Cressley's core story, though.
Yeah.
Cressley's core story is heroine who is already good, solid, right.
And
hero who must change for her.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you're right. That's, yeah. She's not interested in heroines changing, which, you know what? Fine. We're all fucking awesome.
Like, I'm not interested in that either right now. Like, maybe that's why this, I have to say, like, we started this reread almost a year ago, and I was real worried, like, in the climate that we're in, I was worried that these books would not hold up. But they do. And I think the heroines are part of the reason why. Is because there is never a moment where you're like, this heroine is problematic.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, maybe Sabine, maybe, but like, you know.
But she isn't even problematic by the standards of many of the heroes, right?
Oh, like, yeah, it's just right, exactly.
The
standards are different.
Patriarchy.
Yeah. I mean, so I think it's like, I think in this book, it's sort of the same. It's like, she gets to keep being who she is. And like, that's really what the book was about. Like, finding somebody who she wouldn't have to like plan their fucking football parties for.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Okay. I hate to be this person, Kate, but we really didn't talk about sex in this book at all. And I think it's like a really big part of this book.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take a Benadryl.
So. Okay. I was like, just calm yourself. Because I kind of, I think it's really fascinating. Essentially, the setup, right, is that she thinks she's running a kind of con on him where she's going to, like, withhold.
It's a sex game.
Yeah,
it's a sex
right.
Deal. The milk cow, you guys.
The milk cow, right? That's right. And I'm like, milk, I'm laughing, sorry. And I'm a child. I was doing some work on this week's podcast where milk also comes up. That's all you need to know.
Oh.
Anyway.
Take a Benadryl before you listen to that one.
But the part where, like, essentially within a couple of hours of meeting, they, like, really, like, make out big time in this bathroom. And he essentially comes all over her. He comes all over her, right? It is, like, she calls it a real
like a
filthy, filthy cum shot is what she calls it. But one of my favorite parts of that scene is where she's like, okay, why don't you leave when, like, I'm gonna, like, clean up. And he's, like, dumbfounded. He's like, I am to leave? But I think, like, I'm fascinated by how, even though that's, like, the game is, I can't get in bed with this guy, how, hot it is I mean, I just really have to say that, right? It's like in a bathroom, in a limo, like all over the place, in the glass house, right? In the room full of cameras where they're projecting their own selves having sex while they're having sex and watching themselves. It's a whole lot. And I loved it all. Fine. That's all you need to know. There you go.
It is a lot of sex in this book.
Yeah. I was like, how have we gone this far without talking about what is, I think, really big?
But I would say that it's similar to, so we had Sierra Simone on talking about McGreeve and how McGreeve is really where Cressley levels up into erotica. And I think, interestingly, it's possible to sort of draw a line from Dimitri to McGreeve, obviously because of their past.
Right.
But also because the book has to be extra sexy in order to help him heal.
Yeah.
Right? Sex is essential to Dimitri and Vika's relationship because he can't be, in his own mind, a whole person unless he can not dissociate, unless he can be with her, unless he can have pleasure with her, unless he can love her. And the physical is almost the last piece of healing that he has to do.
Well, and I'm also fascinated. The thing I also really was fascinated by is he is horrified by her exhibitionism. He's like really turned on by it because it's her, but he does not want to share her in any way. And I think that's another like really appealing part of like this setup is he's like, I don't like this, but you get off on it big time. And that makes me really happy. So we're going to do this thing, even though I wish I could like never show you to anyone. And I just thought that was like a really interesting, I don't know. I liked it. Great. You do what's right for her. Well done.
Sarah, you said like about this being kind of in the realm of sort of erotic romance. And like whenever when you guys had Sarah on, you talked about this, like how in erotic romance, like the sex is part of kind of the journey between the characters, right? Like each sexual encounter is related to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was true here. Like, their early sexual encounters yes. are connected to the con, right? Like one of them is trying to control the other in some way, right? Mm-hmm. And always it ends up with like one of them has sort of less control than they initially thought, right? So like, you know, when Dimitri says like, okay, like we are going to, I'm going to show you that you really do like oral, right? And so it kind of starts off like, initially when I read that, I was like, oh, this fucking guy, right? Like, yeah. Right. Like she said, she doesn't like it. Right. But, he thinks he's totally in control in that situation. But by the time the encounter ends, right, he's not, right. Like yeah. he's over the top turned on. Right. So like their early encounters are like that. Right. And that I think is why the first time they have sex after they're married. I think that's why that scene is like kind of as tender as it is, because it's like, for yeah. that little space of time, they're not doing that.
Right. Like, she thinks the con is over, right?
Yeah.
And because it's her point of view, she can just, like, be with him. And also, she really quickly understands that this means something really different to him.
Yeah. Yeah. So was that enough for you, Jen? Did you
like me? I have another sex thing.
Oh, okay.
I have another sex thing. I love the moment where she's safe words.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the thing. Here's a personal kink of mine, you guys. I like it when in sex, somebody's safe words and the heroine's safe words and the hero like immediately fucking like tears himself away and like crosses the room to get away from her because he can't, like he's desperate to touch her, but like he deeply respects consent.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
And I mean, like that is pure kink for me. And when she like, but in the moment she's safe words, because it's too much, like it's too intense, right? And it's not just the way it's written, it's not just too intense because of the orgasm, it's too intense because she feels like he's unhinging her.
Yeah.
Like she's, and so she's safe words and he just blows across the room.
Oh, yeah.
And then she's like, no, wait, now I'm better. And he's like, uh-uh. Like, no. Like you, that's that then.
Yeah.
And it's magnificent. I mean, Cressley does consent really beautifully.
Yeah, I
always
agree.
But like it's really awesome here.
Except when that guy like had the doctor come and give her an IUD.
she didn't. Well, that's a different thing.
Yeah, that was all.
That's IUD consent. That's different.
IUD, okay. IAD, whatever it takes. Oh my God. Yeah, that was pretty crazy. But yeah, I mean, I think that, but I also think it's because he like pushes her too far, right? And I also really liked actually that moment. Okay, besides the fact that in that back room, I thought it was like real hot, right? When he unzips her dress and there's like that other threesome across the way. Like she gets really freaked out by it, right? She has done something that she really turned her on and she didn't even know it herself. And she kind of blames him for it. And then I love that she like talks to her sister. I love any book where there like is a strong friendship between women and she has someone to sort of confide in. And then she actually like apologizes to him where she's like, look, I'm real sorry. I just got real freaked out. It was too much for me. And I was upset and I didn't know that I liked it. And you did. And I didn't know what that meant. And I did think that in that way, I guess, I found her, it's not that she changed, right? Like we were talking about earlier, but that she's just such a decent person. I love a character who can say I was wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if she called any of the people she caught
the money. Yeah. No, that was your book, Kate.
Okay. Sorry.
No. But you know what? She didn't have to. I mean, they never felt. The conning was different. And I think that's like another really interesting thing, right? It's like the personal versus the essentially like her emotional personal life is just different and has different rules than her work life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite a book, everyone.
I like this book a lot.
Quite a book.
I really, you know what, Sarah, I loved it this time around. I reread it and thought, I'm not sure the master's my favorite right now.
Oh, there it is.
My goodness.
It's big.
That's
it's a big change.
Big change.
I will say this. I like Kat in the master better than I like Beeka. But I mean, it's Dimitri forever. Hard eyes for Dimitri forever for me. Kate, tell everybody what is next for you.
Well, I have a book coming out at the end of December called Love Lettering, which I'm really excited about.
And it's amazing. I've read it.
You have read it. So I'm really excited about that. And so more information is going to be coming about that soon. And I think ARCs are coming out soon. And so it's a real exciting time. Yeah, so that's coming out next. And if you're curious about it, you can find out more about it on my website, which is kateclaiborne.com. And you can always find me on social media. I'm most active on Twitter, and that's at Kate Claiborne. And on Instagram, I'm at kateclaiborne.author.
What about us? We are, what are we doing, Jen? Tell everybody about us. Where are we going from here?
Well, let me start by telling everybody, if you haven't ordered your copy of Raisin and the Beast, to be sure to do that. It has the best grunting hero written. It's so good. So get that.
Yeah, you should get that.
That's coming at the end of the month, July 30th. But where are we going? But where is Faded Meat?
Oh, sorry.
Oh, after. I was like.
No, thank you. That's great. I love it. Thank you.
Faded Mates, I'm like, we are recording a bunch. We'll have some more interstitials. We're gonna do Shadows Seduction and Shadows Claim together next.
Okay. In two weeks.
Yeah, in 2 weeks. And then 2 weeks after that will be Wicked Abyss.
And then it's season two is coming.
Yeah.
We'll do a little preview and then maybe take a week off and then season two.
Well, and here's the one thing I will say. When Monroe is released. Well, obviously for any other future IAD
book. For the rest of time.
Yes.
Like Jen and I will be 83.
Yeah.
And we will record our podcast in our brains, or however it is we're doing that then.
Sure, of course.
When Cressley releases IAD number 200. So.
Wow.
The twins, Holly and Kate's twins.
I know. Forever, you guys, or at least, in the foreseeable future, when Cressley releases a new IAD book, we will release a new podcast.
Yeah. But until then, Shadow's Claim is a full length like novel. Shadow's Seduction is shorter. It's like a novella. So we feel confident that you will be able to get ready. And you know what? I'm going to right now, which is like July 7th or 8th, I'm going to put that on the Twitter so that people will know to get ready.
What an exciting time.
I know. We live in exciting times. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Faded Mates. We thank Kate Claiborne for being our special guest, and we'll see you next time.